Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
The Big Food Question is partnering with TD Bank on 5 special episodes about the resilience of small businesses in the face of a constantly shifting pandemic landscape. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my good guests. And my guests today are J.T. Wong and George Padilla, the executive chef and the co-founding partner and co-owners of Rule of Thirds in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, New York. George and J.T. met at Okonomi, a charming Japanese restaurant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and after working for several years together, they opened Rule of Thirds in February 2020. What a timing. It was a month before the outbreak of COVID-19. But the duo managed to get through the challenges in the pandemic, and luckily, we can discover the great new restaurant in person now. So today, we'll discuss how George and JT got into Japanese food, their ideas of Japanese food culture, how they communicate the idea at Rule of Thirds through their outstanding hospitality and unique dishes, creative programs they offer to enjoy Japanese flavors, and much, much more. But before we start, Japanese is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japanese. And please write to our review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with George Padilla and J.T. Wong. Hello, George. Hello, J.T. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Kiko-san. Hi. Thank you so much for having us.
So, well, I've been to Okonomi many times, thanks to your amazing talents and work, hard work. So it's very exciting to have you here. So first of all, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
Hi, so I'm JT. I was born in Taiwan, but I moved to New York when I was really young, flew back and forth a lot. I feel I ate a really healthy mix of Eastern and Western cuisines. But particularly love certain things like lasagna.
Okay. And what about you, George?
Hi, I'm George Padilla, and I grew up and I was born in St. Louis, Missouri. So growing up in school, we had a good amount of Midwestern comfort food, macaroni and cheese. I remember loving at the school cafeteria. But my family is from the Philippines. My parents are from the Philippines. And so I grew up eating some of their home-style Filipino food dishes, adobo, of course, sinigang. And one thing that I really remember being a little bit different than the other families around us was having fish for breakfast. So I also had an uncle from Hong Kong, so I had a chance to go out for dim sum at a young age and eat some Cantonese food in their home with his homegrown garden vegetables.
Mm. Right. So both of you, no question, you grew up in a very good, rich food environment.
Yeah, luckily.
Right. So, all right. And then you met at Okonomi at a charming neighborhood Japanese breakfast and ramen place at night in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. But before you joined Okonomi, what did you do?
Before I started Okonomi and food in general, I worked in wholesale for a little bit right after college, but it just didn't feel right. Didn't really feel there's no passion behind it. eventually I started working in food as well, which I was much more passionate about. I'm not sure because it was like maybe hard deadlines, or it's very hands-on, or there's actually like the results come in much sooner. But I had a great time. And then right before I started working at Uji Ramen Okonomi, I worked at a sushi restaurant in the suburbs and kind of developed a real love for seafood and fish in general along the East Coast. And that's kind of how I fell into Uji Ramen and met George.
Right.
Before working at Okonomi, I was working in environmental consulting, and I always felt like I had a bit more of a generalist approach to studying and to working. So I actually moved to New York with the intention of working in the field of environmental health and environmental health policy. It was quite a surprise when almost 10 years after moving to New York, I found myself working in Japanese restaurants. But I always made a joke when I first arrived in New York that I picked New York over some of the other cities I was looking for potentially going to school, because New York had more access to Japanese restaurants, and turned out to be the whole reason why I'm still here.
Right. And as far as I understand, you went to the Columbia University and you have a Master of Public Health. So you're really like the specialist of environmental and industrial health matters, right?
Yeah, it was a pretty interesting field to get into. One of the reasons why I wanted to study public health is that in my undergrad program, I went to college in Portland, Oregon. It's a beautiful part of the country to study conservation biology and ecology. And I felt that if you weren't able to convince people and convey the importance of taking care of the environment for your own health and for the health of those around you, then it just didn't have as salient of an argument to preserve ecosystems and habitats and take care of nature. So that's why I ended up pursuing a degree in public health. And along the way, I was looking at fish consumption as a kind of nexus issue that tied together a lot of my different academic interests and love for food. And so ending up working with Yuji-san, our mentor at Uji Ramen and Okonomi, and his focus on fish and seafood helped kind of bring together a lot of my different interests into something that I felt very passionate about. I think I have a similar story to JT in that, I had a good job and was enjoying being in the city and working, but I felt like at the end of the day, the product and the what we were creating was not something that inspired me. And so moving over into food service and hospitality really just kind of fell in love with working.
Right. Well, first time I met you at Okonomi, your eyes were sparkling and wow, this person is really like full of hope. And that was a very welcoming ambience you created at Okonomi. So, all right. So you met at Okonomi and worked closely together, meaning closely physically at the very tiny and wonderful restaurant. So what did you learn from the experience?
Like you said, it's very, very, very tiny restaurant. So we learned to work on a lot of different constraints, like how much product we could have in house, how much we can actually order, and particularly like much more hands-on with procurement of items, all different aspects of management, because we didn't have the space to actually hire other people to do certain aspects of the job. But one of the big things I learned after working there for a long time was how I personally view food, and how just the two of us, and I mean obviously with our coworkers as well, but how we can actually determine how the atmosphere and the environment of the place felt. And one of, I guess, one of the really important things I kind of picked up there was the concept of motenai, how to kind of like utilize different parts of either animal or plant, and you know, show respect for it and not kind of just waste it.
Right. So motenai really is a key word in Japanese cuisine, right? It's like there are different translations, but motenai means what a waste. You can't waste that, or let's save it. Some kind of like we eat the whole thing, like from head to tail, literally. That's Japanese mindset. And also practically, you do it. And JT does it too on your plate. So we're going to get into that later. But, well, that's interesting. So that's like Yuji Taruguchi, the Honorable Economy, and Yuji Ramen's tagline. It's mottainai, right?
I would agree that I think mottainai, being kind of immersed in that idea of mottainai approach to the cuisine, but not even the cuisine. I think one thing I really appreciate Yuji-san talking about is applying that idea of mottainai to the business as well, and the way you use space. I mean, the restaurant at Okonomi was, I think, you know, maybe 20 different or 20 Okonomis could fit in the size of rule of thirds. Or let me put it another way. Okonomi was about maybe 400 square feet, and all of the space that we have at rule of thirds totals about 10,000 square feet. So I think it really gave us a pretty unique start in working in restaurants in a place that was so spatially constrained, but finding a lot of creative and innovative ways to do more and more within that space.
Right. Actually, Yuji Haraguchi came to Japan a while ago, and then, yeah, that the usage of space, the more you have space, the more you accumulate waste. So that's the same mindset. It's kind of like, what can you eliminate? Just like Japanese cuisine with sushi. Less is more, the kind of idea. So, okay. And this is very big question I wanted to ask you. So you are not from Japan, but you are passionately and very effectively supporting Japanese food and food culture. So what is your idea of Japanese food culture, and what is special about it to you personally?
That's a pretty big question. Well, I'm not from Japan. Since I am from Taiwan, there's between the proximity and relationship between the two countries, there has been a lot of Japanese cultural influence in my life that I didn't really recognize until later on, when I started reading more about like history and food history as well. But I also want to preface with that, like, I feel that, you know, the average person doesn't view Japanese cuisine as like as diverse as it truly is. Each prefecture, specifically if they're further apart, is very different, and it's kind of hard to get like a, I don't know, I feel like it's hard for me to give a general idea of the food culture, because, like, for instance, you know, there's, like you said, there's sushi, there's very simple, clean, how to bring out the, you know, the best, the natural flavors in the season, and then there's also the more old school, like, grandma approach of like how to make the best with what you have to make other people happy. Mm-hmm. But I think overall is the idea of A, making people happy, and kind of not necessarily simplifying is not the right word, but keeping what your dish is as the most like clean presentation of the natural flavors. Not as much, whereas Western cuisine, there's a ton of salt added to, well, not a ton, but salt is added to make whatever food item taste like that food item. But I feel that it kind of takes away from the other subtle flavors of, you know, for instance, tomatoes. Like, if you add salt, obviously it tastes more like tomatoes, will taste more like tomatoes, but then you kind of lose certain nuances of the tomato from the tomato tasting more like tomatoes, if that makes any sense.
Right. Okay. So what about you, George?
For me as well, I think there's this, I have a really strong affinity for that sense of simplicity in Japanese cuisine. I was actually just thinking of a line in Hannah Krishner's book that I'm reading right now called Water, Wood, and Wild Things, where she's basically giving a portrait of a little story about an artist living in a rural town in Ishikawa. And there's a line about this artist, her art is making traditional paper, and Hannah's writing about how there something doesn't have to be conceptually complex to be compelling. And I think that's just, that to me sums up why I eat Japanese food basically every day. I mean, I even, you know, from the time at Okonomi, Japanese breakfast is something that's kind of the only thing I eat for breakfast at home, making miso soup and having just a little bit of rice and pickles and just, you know, not going too far in excess with protein or trying to fuss too much with it. So, I mean, aesthetically and kind of practically, that's what I'm most attracted to in Japanese cuisine. But it really started for me when I went away to college in Portland, Oregon. There were a few Japanese international students at my school, and my best friend in particular kind of really introduced me to Japanese cuisine when he started cooking in the dorm. So as you know, moving away from home for the first time, Japanese food really became my comfort food away from home, and I didn't know, like JT is talking about, there are these influences that you look back later on in life and you can see how it became part of your identity in a way. And so that's really how I started appreciating and finding a lot of satisfaction in Japanese food and cuisine. Mm. But I also really like that there's, you know, so having Japanese cuisine become my adopted comfort food and it invoking this familiar and wholesome feeling, I also really appreciate how there's a pretty strong defining framework to Japanese cuisine and this reliance on simple building blocks like dashi and koji fermentation that give washoku its really distinctive quality. And something else that I took away from Okonomi and Yuji-san's mission was really to teach people that you can practice Japanese cuisine anywhere if you have an understanding of those foundations. And so you can practice Japanese cuisine in New York City, not using the exact same ingredients, although there are some things like katsuobushi and soy sauce and miso that are imported, but it's the feeling and the approach that you take with what's available around you.
Right. Yeah, both of you. It's amazing. So well said. Okay. And so you opened the Wolf Thurs in February 2020 and right before the break of COVID-19. So we'll talk about your survival story in a moment, but you did survive the pandemic. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And you opened Wolf Thurs with the team behind Sunday Hospitality, which owns and operates the fabulous restaurant called Sunday in Brooklyn. In Williamsburg, Brooklyn. So how did the interesting partnership begin?
Well, so Adam Landsman, Todd and Annie, Jamie Young, our partners from Sunday in Brooklyn, from Sunday Hospitality, they lived in our neighborhood of Williamsburg. Or actually, I'm the only one of the partners that wasn't living in Williamsburg. I actually lived in Prospect Heights, but spent all my time in Williamsburg. And they would come in into Okonomi on their days off. We got to know each other just kind of casually as them as patrons to our restaurant. And I remember when Sunday in Brooklyn first opened, this was in, I believe, November 2016. And JT and I just walked in, you know, didn't have a reservation for the opening night of Sunday in Brooklyn. And they just took such good care of us. It was, you know, it was really kind of overwhelming, their hospitality that we experienced when we'd heard about them working on opening this restaurant for so long. And so we really became closer as friends by supporting each other's businesses. And I think that it's always important to support your friends. And though, you know, in this industry, time off is quite limited, I do try to get around the city and see as many of my hardworking friends as possible, and not just at restaurants, but you know, there are so many people working in their respective fields, and I think it means a lot to support them, because I wouldn't have the opportunity to be doing the work that I do if it weren't for their support as well.
Right. And first time I got to know about the partnership. I know the three great team members of Sunday Hospitality, and I instantly thought, wow, that's a great chemistry. You guys, all five of you, have very similar mindset of trying to make you happy. And not also, you have to have fun. You have to be happy to make you happy too. So it's like a really relaxed, nice, happy feeling being with you guys. So I'm so glad you did open World Source together. So
yeah, I am too. And I think it's kind of surprising too, because we all come from such different experience and perspective and backgrounds. But yeah, I think you kind of nailed on the head, is that the intention is to have fun, and we all have a very strong sense of hospitality kind of coming first. And that's really what ties our relationship all together, is that intention.
Right. Yeah, it's like, I know it's a business that you have to keep running, but I also think it's just a friendship and teamed up and having fun and try to involve everybody, including your guests, to be happy. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right, so we'll take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll dive into the fascinating and delicious concept of world thirst. So please stay with us.
The Big Food Question is partnering with TD Bank on 5 special episodes about the resilience of small businesses in the face of a constantly shifting pandemic landscape. We cover avenues for accessing grants, loans, and financial services through federal and local government programs, as well as via nonprofits. We examine the benefits worker cooperatives present to workers, communities, and our food system, and share resources to learn more about operating under this model. We're talking to business owners who started pop-ups and became permanent during the pandemic to see what we can learn. Don't miss these episodes. Subscribe to The Big Food Question wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to TD Bank for supporting this programming.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Aki Kotayama, and my guests today are JT Wong and George Padilla, the executive chef and the co-founding partner of World Thirst in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, New York. So let's talk about World Thirst. So what is the concept of World of Thirst, and what would you like to achieve through the restaurant?
Well, World of Thirst is an izakaya restaurant. And so when we explain what this restaurant is, it's really a place to get together with people and enjoy drinks and food and have a range of Japanese style dishes. It's not to specialize in one particular item. We don't just specialize in ramen or in sushi or one thing. But which is hard for some people to understand when you think of these Japanese cuisine being compartmentalized and having specific restaurants that focus on a specific type of food. But to us, izakaya is more the experience of getting together and drinking and eating around a table.
Right. Okay. Well, I have to say, you really picked the essence of good parts of Japanese, like everybody's favorite too. So
it's hard to pick your favorite parts. So I think we get away with it a little bit by being more general. And JT, do you have anything to add about the menu? We talk about, or we've oftentimes struggled with trying to categorize or break up the sections of the menu, because to us, The experience is kind of, we look at it as a whole, and it's a little bit difficult to say that this dish belongs in this part of the menu and not the other part of the menu, because we want everybody to have everything.
Mm. Right. Well, actually, that's the essence of izakaya. Like, your Japanese izakaya, there's so many izakaya restaurants and a lot of chain and inexpensive chain izakaya restaurants. And the point is that you're like a group of 10 people. Everybody has their favorite. And then you just enjoy and you can just order as many or as little as you want and drink and have fun. And yeah, I think you really do offer this sense of izakaya spirit at Rural Thirds. Anything that JD do you think?
Yeah, like George said, I think it's hard for us to pinpoint because we're trying to, you know, everybody asks what the restaurant is, cuisine-wise and food-wise, and sometimes it's like, oh, this, you know, people are like, oh, this food from this region, doing this style or something. But for us, it's, you know, putting out an entire package, how it feels, how the atmosphere is, and at the end of the day, just feeding people and making sure everybody has fun.
Right. And now that you mentioned the atmosphere, and for listeners who have not been to Rural Thirds, can you describe the restaurant's ambience and the neighborhood? Because it's very impressive. It's almost the opposite of the little tiny economy, and it's the very different types of charms. So can you describe the ambience?
The restaurant ambience and the environment really came together as a reflection of the collaboration between JT and myself and our partners at Sunday Hospitality and all of the really talented creative people that we wanted to get involved with the restaurant design. So, you know, if you were to look at a table at Rule of Thirds, and I mean the table in the middle of a meal, and you see different pieces of pottery, maybe from three different local artisans and mixed in with plates from Japan and water glasses from IKEA. The whole concept was for things to come together and play well together on the table. So even though things are coming from, you know, different places and even of different scale of production, it all comes together on the table. And that's kind of, not to jump ahead too much, but, and that's kind of the intention of the philosophy behind the name Rule of Thirds, is that what happens at those intersections is most compelling when you're bringing together different intersecting lines or different intersecting perspective, and the most compelling compositions come at those intersections.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you that the origin of Rule of Thirds, it's like outward, right? So, right. So if you cut the one frame into like two lines, vertical, horizontal, and you get nine sections, and you put the point of like center, like, you know, like I can explain really well enough, like, you know, our students, but yeah, I think that's a very cool name just to express just what you said. So yeah, naming is very clever too. So, okay. And well, how many seats do you have at the Rural Thirds?
Too many.
Yeah, for a chef, right? Probably.
Yeah, I think JT's calculated there's a bajillion more seats than at Okonomi. But we do have about just under 100 seats in the main indoor dining room. That includes six seats in front of the kitchen counter, and then depending on the setup of the bar, anywhere between 10 to 16 seats at the bar, and then the remainder of the seats are spread out through different, you know, the different pockets of the dining room. In addition to that, almost 100 seats, there's some three private dining rooms. We have an outdoor garden or courtyard with about 14 tables. So that could be, you know, up to 60 people or so. And then we have, as a COVID innovation, we built four really comfortable outdoor dining bungalows that got us through the winter, and they're still available to sit in during the summertime, and it provides a little bit of a different cozy semi-private experience for your group. And on the other side of the restaurant, behind the main dining room, we have another 4,000 square feet for event space. So this summer we've done several weddings, and we did a really fun sake tasting benefit event. And so there's a lot of different ways to experience Rural Thirds. But at the heart of it is the dining room, and that's just under 100 seats.
Right. Well, I'm sure listeners might thinking like you guys are billionaires to get that space. But another point is that it's in Greenpoint, which is a cool neighborhood. And it's not like a midtown Manhattan. So can you maybe talk about the neighborhood, Greenpoint?
So Greenpoint is in North Brooklyn. It's just north of Williamsburg. If you haven't heard of Greenpoint, you've probably heard of Williamsburg. But it's the neighborhood that we've been working in Williamsburg for years at our years at Okonomi. Sunday in Brooklyn is also located in Williamsburg. And we've always thought of these restaurants as really neighborhood restaurants first, you know, to be there on a daily basis for people that just live locally around the restaurants, although we're really lucky to be visited from by guests from around the five boroughs and people visiting the city. Ultimately, we want to have a very comfortable place open for all of our friends in the neighborhood. And being in Greenpoint is great because it's actually not quite far from Okonomi, and so we love seeing our old regular guests here at Rule of Thirds as well as meeting regulars from Sunday in Brooklyn.
Right. So Greenpoint is kind of newly being developed area, and whenever I go pass by any streets in Greenpoint, there are new places opening, and it's a very used to be like a lot of warehouse and factories, and it's a beautiful place and near the river. So yeah, it's a really nice place, and that spaciousness really gives that kind of Japanese natural sense. So yeah, really got the nice space.
Yes, right. There's a lot of really nice quiet residential areas near the restaurant in Greenpoint. Our particular block in Greenpoint has been historically industrial. And so this building that we're in, don't know exactly how old it is. It's probably around 80 to 100 years old. And it had been used for many different things in the past. There was a bakery here called Angel's Bakery that some of the neighbors remember. And the current landlord and the building owner actually operated a brassiere factory here in the past. There was Brooklyn Night Bazaar, and there's been a lot of different uses in this building. And to go back to the design aspect of it, and the feeling and the ambiance of this restaurant, it was really important to soften and make this industrial space feel a lot warmer. We have unfinished concrete floors and it's open exposed rafters, but Lauren Day from Studio Love Is Enough did a really beautiful job of making the space feel warm and cozy by introducing a lot more wood elements and earth tones that help invoke the calm feeling that we're trying to convey.
Right. So, by the way, we'll talk about the food and drink menus in a moment, but there's a question to you, George. So I have been always impressed by how you communicate with your guests. So it is always, I think it's very sincere and warm, and guests know that you are on their side to make you happy. So what's your idea of hospitality?
It's a good question. I still try to define hospitality myself, especially as I'm trying to teach and pass along to staff the way that I hope we're able to treat and take care of our guests here. But ultimately, I think I'd learned and developed my own approach to hospitality because I didn't come from restaurants when I started working at Okonomi. It was the first restaurant that I'd ever worked in. But very quickly, what I realized and what was so inspiring about being working in Okonomi and at that place was that I saw that restaurants can create family and can create community. And it can connect you with all kinds of people from all over the world. And and I think hospitality really comes from, at least my hospitality, I feel like comes from a place of mutual respect. And it's that, you know, I really appreciate so much the business and the livelihood that our guests are bringing to us by coming to patronize our restaurant. And so in turn, I think, you know, I want to show them the generosity and give them the warm welcome that they deserve. And it really is a synergistic and kind of, mutual sharing of energy. That's what I feel. And that's why I really love being part of restaurants and working in this field, is that, I feel a lot of positive energy, you know, back and forth being with our guests and working with our team and with with the community here.
I think also your this is a totally stereotype probably, but I think your Filipino background, every single friend of mine from the Filipino background, they're so nice and just naturally welcoming and caring. So sorry, I'm a bit stereotyped on this.
Well, I think, I mean, my family, we would get together in St. Louis, and it was, you know, a large extended family. And so our holiday parties were always, you know, 40 or more people. And I remember how much my dad really loved entertaining at our house. And, you know, not only family, but when you'd invite his colleagues from work and all of that. So we were inviting a lot of guests to our family home. And so I think, of course, that's something that has been ingrained in my experience growing up and comes out naturally, I hope, in my work.
Right. And so let's talk about food at Rope Thirds. So so what do you call the style of food at Rope Thirds? Is it a classic or traditional or modern creative or somewhere in between, or what do you think?
I guess it's the same thing we, George, and I have a problem with trying to figure out what the cuisine is and how to describe the restaurant. But I guess the easiest answer, even though it gets a lot of flack, is that it's basically fusion. Like, I feel that honestly, a majority of food is fusion in general, because throughout, you know, history and different cultures, like you share food with other people, and then you welcome other people from different backgrounds into your house. You you feed them, they take away something, and then someone else, you know, they bring that food home with them, regardless if it's intentional or not. I feel like everybody's always hunting after the idea of like authentic, but nobody really, you know, what makes food authentic, and maybe it doesn't naturally sit with the times as well. That said, I think the food here is kind of like how New American is French based, but we base our food more in Japanese background, techniques, and culture.
Right. That's well said, right? It's like a food is always a moving target, especially in the places like in New York. So, but I think your food is always based on the classic, I mean, the authenticity, and then you add some elements. So do you have any example of your creative aspects that you added to the authenticity?
I think a lot, like I said, is fusion. There are some certain dishes, I think particularly we do a kasujiru, which is a soup or stew that, and we use sake kasu, which is the lees or pressings left over from making sake. We get it locally from Brooklyn Kura because it's much more floral, whereas if something's shipped overseas and frozen, you lose that great aroma. So traditionally, I think it's mostly pork, and I've seen also people do it with salmon. And I thought it'd be interesting to make kind of like a pork and bean stew, so kind of combining basically Eats Meets West idea, but it's more of like an organic fusion, whereas instead of certain certain styles of food, like swap out one ingredient for one ingredient. This is more of the idea of making a warm, comfort, nourishing stew. It turned out super delicious, of course, because we get really great katsu. Mm. But at the end of the day, we felt that the pork was necessary, so we tried mushrooms and then ended up making a vegan dish that was also, I think, actually more delicious. And we kind of also want to, you know, be inclusive and welcome, you know, vegetarians, vegans, people with different dietary backgrounds. We want them to also be able to come in and have a great time. And that is how one of the dishes kind of was formed.
Mm, right. Interesting.
I tell guests all the time that I think this is one of the most unique and surprising dishes on the menu. And like GT mentioned, you know, we're so lucky to have be able to work with super fresh sake katsu from Brooklyn Kura. And you know, to be able to pick up the katsu the morning that it's been pressed, and it's really just still alive with so much of the fragrance and aroma of the sake and the koji enzymes still active, it makes a huge difference, and it's like night and day compared to the other imported and frozen katsu that we were accustomed to using before.
Mm, right. Yeah, so listeners who are not familiar with Brooklyn Kura, that is the first New York authentic sake brewery, and they're doing very, very well. And I see their products everywhere. And also their sake kasu is being used in many places, which is great because, like you said, fresh sake lees are not available easily. And anything frozen, the bacteria is kind of dead, so you don't get the flavor. And probably it's more nutritious too. So, okay, so that's sake kasu, kasujiru. That's the name of the dish, which is very traditional, but your twist.
Another good example of JT's, he calls it fusion. And I mean, I think it's accurate to say, even though some people in the food industry think fusion's a bit of a dirty word, but his almond miso soup is a really great example of just a simple addition of something that exists in Western cuisine but is not traditional or authentic to the way miso soup is made.
Mm, so tell us more.
I guess one of the things was when we were working at Okonomi Nijirama with Yuji-san, he had this, I remember noticed one day that he's like really into, or at least at that time he was really into eating nuts and adding it to certain dishes because we have a ton of nuts in the West, but they're not as popular or as readable or as inexpensive as they are in Japan. And then I guess I just stored that in my memory. And then one day, after I left, I was helping out working at Sunday in Brooklyn. They use actually a lot of different nut butters as well as making different misos out of nuts. And then I don't remember what happened. Maybe it's like one of those things where you just like wake up in the middle of the night and it clicks. But it's like, wait, why can't we just do a nut butter and miso soup? So I tried it out and it's like, oh yeah, that's pretty good. Obviously, there's a couple of tweaks, but it's a very kind of same idea. We had to go for a slightly thicker miso soup, more like the more kansai style, like more white miso and almond, but that adds like a lot of earthiness at the same time.
Huh. So you mix the almond butter and the miso, white miso, is that what it is?
Yeah, specifically use saikyo miso and a little bit of barley miso, because the barley miso also has a little bit of that nuttiness behind it to kind of complement each other.
Mm, wow, that's genius. So it's almond. I'm sure you're going to try like walnuts or whatever. I don't know. Have you ever tried other flavors too?
Yeah, I haven't done it yet, unfortunately, due to COVID. But I was planning using maybe a hacho miso and kind of like maybe cashews or walnuts, something a bit heavier for like different season.
Mm, wow, that's amazing. Yeah, I'm so glad Georgia gave us that. That's a great example. Okay, so, and also I have to say, one of the things really is really good, your binchotan skewers are very interesting because, you know, binchotan is a Japanese charcoal with a very efficient heat source. It's a charcoal, but special charcoal. And you use animals, unusual parts of animals, like duck hearts, flavored with soy, garlic, jalapeno, and sesame. And you have pork jiao with yuzu kosho, which is a Japanese spicy condiment, and lamb tongue, and with yakitori tare, and the Japanese karashi mustard. So these are, you know, like we talked about mottainai, don't waste it. That the mindset is really showcased in this bento dan skewer dishes. And I know they're so delicious. So that was one of the features I think we should know about on the menu at World of Thirst.
One of the ideas when we first designed the menu for the restaurant, one of the things I thought about a lot was like there are a ton of great yakitori restaurants. So even if we try to do yakitori, to me it didn't make sense. You know, there's everybody else can do it better, and I don't want to put out a subpar product. There are people who've been training, you know, 10, 20 years, and then also brought in from Japan to open these kind of places. And business sense, it didn't make any sense. And also just like as creatively, it didn't make sense as well. So we started trying to, you know, play around with different plants and animals, use different combinations. And I guess one of the things of like obviously Georgian aren't Japanese, but one of the benefits of that is that we can kind of stretch out a bit more and not get flack for doing things out of the norm. Usually the offcuts are the things we kind of prefer eating all the time, and also the whole mottainai concept. It's like it just kind of came together naturally.
Right. Yeah, and also I think that kind of out-of-the-box idea inspires Japanese chefs in Japan too. So, yeah, I really think this is your creativity is very inspiring to all of us. And, I mean, use of these organ meats, not to mention they're highly nutritious, and we tend to lack that kind of specific vitamins and minerals. So, yeah, you're creating healthy dishes too. So that's awesome. Okay, so I want to talk about brunch menu too, because you really showcase very unique Japanese items. That's, you know, like a Japanese breakfast set, that's roasted market fish, and hot cake, that's a Japanese souffle pancake, and Japanese sandwiches, so which is a little different. So maybe you can tell us some details about your brunch menu.
So the brunch menu at Rule of Thirds, at the core of it, is based around teishoku set meals. And initially we were thinking of focusing on bento, and we had a difficult time finding just the right bento vessel for the meal and for it to fit into the restaurant and to fit into the service. So these teishoku meals are meant to have, you know, everything that you need to have a complete and balanced meal. There are a yakizakana, roasted fish version. We have a chicken meatball tsukune version. There's a vegan version with shimeji mushroom and barley miso. And so those are the kind of the main attraction for the brunch menu. But to also introduce, you know, a little bit of the style of eating at an izakaya for the daytime, there's a lot of things that are great for sharing. So some of the dinner menu crosses over to the brunch menu. Karaage is on the menu, and some of the side smashed cucumbers. But exclusive to the daytime are some sandos, so some milk bread sandwiches that we get the bread from a relatively new local vendor, native bread, and sandwiches are always fun for people to share, to get as their own. And for the sandwiches, we have a tamagoyaki and also a chicken katsu.
I really wanted to talk about brunch menu, because, like, you know, Japanese style breakfast set menu, like you said, That's the concept of Ichiju Sansai, is that's the most balanced style of meal. One rice, one soup, and three small dishes, or the one large dish or two small dishes. So yeah, it really represents the healthy part of Japanese cuisine. And also, I think, you know, Japanese sandwiches, it's not well known enough in this country, but I saw many Olympic journalists, reporters who went to Tokyo this time, reported a number of times on social media their Japanese sandwiches experience was crazy, like so fluffy bread and just delicious. And I heard that Anthony Bourdain, he used to go to Japan and he would always go to Japanese convenience stores and eat Japanese sandwiches because it's so good. So I'm so glad you're featuring those items at Wolfers.
I mean, the milk bread itself is just so like so soft, it's almost unreal sometimes.
Yeah, fluffy. And it's you said you get from local bakery?
Yeah, so the one we get is a little bit denser and harder than more standard milk bread, which kind of it kind of fits our sandals a bit better. It's kind of help acclimate people towards a style of sandos, but also it holds up a bit better to our sando applications of like kind of a bit more saucy and gives a more textural contrast for us as well.
Mm, okay. So by the way, so in Japan, sandwiches are called sando. So it's sando is just Japanese style sandwiches. Okay. And so I think we should talk about your amazing sake list. So you have about 30 sake labels on your list. So so I'd imagine you have many customers who are not familiar with Japanese sake, considering how modern and Wolfers look. So what's the theme of sake list, and what kind of customer do you have in mind?
So the general theme of the sake list at Rule of Thirds is sake for natural wine lovers. I, through working at Okonomi, was really lucky to be able to meet some amazing sake importers and distributors, and through them had a chance to meet several sake brewers and brewery owners and tojis, and was really inspired by their stories and their craft, and had a chance to visit several sake breweries over trips to Japan. And so professionally I was drinking and tasting and really enjoying sake. After work a few years ago, I started to get more into enjoying wine. So through restaurants like at the Four Horsemen, also in Williamsburg, really started to branch out, and wine started becoming my go-to or beverage outside of the workplace. So in opening the restaurant here and thinking about combining, you know, this kind of professional experience with sake with kind of extracurricular passion and love for wine, I thought that it'd be fun to frame the list as sake for natural wine lovers. And a big portion of our menu here is to introduce people to namazake. So namazake is unpasteurized sake that has a little bit more of a surprising liveliness to it, and it can have a little bit more zip and electricity to it. And I think namazake serves to be a really great gateway to sake for people that have not had a chance to taste many different sakes side by side.
Mm.
And the goal is to find something for everyone. I think that there's a place for both sake and wine at the table at the same time. And so, you know, my hope is that people will appreciate sake with its richness and umami and amino acids, and how it's such an effortless pairing with Japanese cuisine and the Japanese palette of flavors were in the food. And then my approach for wine is that the wine almost functions as the pickles on the table. So, you know, in choosing wines that are really bright and have a so a lot of acidity to them, low in tannin, refreshing. I think it makes space for you to enjoy both wine and sake together at the same time.
Right. Interesting. Right. Well, that's the keyword, right? Natural wine, natural drink. And by the way, for listeners who are not familiar with sake too much, sake is a very natural product by nature. So there's no additives. It's just pure ingredients. So every sake, unless it's really like, I don't know, it has to be pure, unless it's like a modified somewhere, somebody created an artificial product, which I'm not aware of. Sake is natural, but namazake, unpasteurized, like George said, it's a very lively product. So it's really, the brightness is very easy for non-sake lovers to love. So that's exciting.
I think namazake is a really great starting point. As I mentioned, it's a really good gateway into explaining, a different style or range of sake. But to me, you know, pasteurization is not the end all or be all of sake that's worthwhile drinking or you know, even a natural sake. What I've really enjoyed showing people and helping to educate on is a little bit of the traditional yeast starter methods that I think also give certain sakes a totally different character. And so traditional yeast starter methods such as Kimoto and Yamahai and Bodaimoto, I think there's some really great comparisons to be made between those old school styles of sake and the new school Sokujo method sakes that are much, much more common. And I think they're all styles that are worth drinking, but it's great to have, we have some 30 different sakes available to pour by the cup with a carafe, and tasting side by side and together in the same experience is really where you start to learn.
Right. So it's not just the unpasteurized fresh sake, but like you said, Yamahai, Kimoto, those really old classic style tend to be labor intensive. So that's why there is a trend. People didn't produce those, but there is a kind of trend that reversed. People are just going for more flavor, more kind of sometimes funky, more layers. That's the style of sake you're serving at Wolf Thirst, right?
Correct.
Right. Okay, a lot to discover. As far as I counted it, you have around 30 sake labels on the list. So yeah, I have to keep going back. So you have created this fascinating restaurant that showcases really the essence of Japanese culture. You went through the crazy COVID challenges. So how did you deal with the challenges due to the pandemic?
Well, the challenges aren't over yet. I mean, we're still
that's true.
We're still in the middle of the pandemic, but certainly we're in a better place than we were a year ago, or more than a year ago, or right after the restaurant opened. And it's been quite challenging, but our approach has been to always to follow the science and the public health experts, and to learn from our peers, and to be flexible. There have been just a number of constant changes that we've had to make, and I feel like we've reopened the restaurant four times or so, just in the different iterations of being outdoor only, and then reopening indoors, and then indoors being closed for a portion of time. And I'm still processing all of the challenges, that's for sure. But we have been able to make it through this really difficult period because of the tenacity of all of the people working here and involved with this project. And yeah, we're able to still be here because of our team, and because without that, this restaurant wouldn't have been able to reopen. So very grateful for that and about taking care of this restaurant family.
Hey, yeah, I'm
It's
so glad.
not very much of specifics, but there's a lot. Certainly the PPP program helped us bring staff back and keep staff on when even the volume of business was not enough to sustain our payroll at the reduced levels of capacity that we're operating at. So a little bit of help along the way has been critical. A good relationship with our landlord has also been critical in renegotiating our lease during the pandemic and during the shutdown when we weren't even operating the restaurant, to make sure that we had a favorable lease that allowed us time to ramp up and to get back on track, and also set us up for a little bit of a long-term stability in the space. So those are all really important factors leading to us being able to continue.
So, like you said, COVID is not over yet, but I think vaccination rates keeps going up. So hopefully, even the Delta variant is going to disappear soon. So assuming that's going to happen, what are your plans and dreams?
Plans and dreams. I guess get the restaurant back in full running mode. For me, one of my dreams, and one reason I fell, I guess a double back, one reason I really like Japanese food culture and cuisine is it's basically everybody's always working to improve, no matter how small the gain is. Like before I started cooking, I was really into Muay Thai, and then or martial arts are in general. And Bruce, and one of the quotes that Bruce Lee had always stuck with me is that something along the lines of like, I don't fear the man who's practiced 1,000 or 10,000 kicks once, but I fear the man who's practiced one kick 1,000 times. And I feel that's very the hard work, but also just the drive to be better and work harder and make. And just basically work harder to be better, and that's kind of one thing I've noticed that a lot of people that have gotten to cooking are not into as much anymore. They're not into putting the hard work, and they want to do and learn a thousand different things. Whereas, I remember when I started doing sushi, I don't know how many cucumbers I destroyed practicing, but doing katsuramuki, like every day I would go in, they'd give me 20 cucumbers, and then just practice for like 2 hours, and that kind of like. That drive and perseverance, I kind of hope to pass on to the next generation of kitchen staff at least.
Wow. I'm so glad I asked you this question. Hey, I mean, in the Japanese mindset, it's called sometimes Kaizen, meaning permanent eternal improvement. And I think that itself is the essence of love for what you do, right? Because if you don't, you can't have that. And it's almost like you are asking yourself what value you can create, not just for yourself, but for whole society. So that's the kind of mindset I think I really respect you have, JT. What about you, George?
Well, I mean, the dream is to keep rule of thirds growing, and I think, like JT said, just incremental improvements and developments are something that really drives all of us. And I'm really striving for this place and this entire venue to provide a really dynamic experience. I think, something that the way we've designed and thought of the experience of visiting this restaurant is to have a little bit of a journey and discovery along the way. And I mean, even just walking into the courtyard, there's a sense that you're coming out of the streets of New York City and into a place that can hopefully be transportive for you. And so taking that intention of creating a dynamic experience with discovery and journey, but then applying that to the trajectory of the business and seeing what more we can do in this box that we have. We have a new project called Bin Bin Sake, where we intend to open a sake bottle shop and a sake retail shop here that is, you know, forthcoming, pending application for new retail permit to sell sake out of a new space that's a new space that we signed a new lease on in the building. But building up to that, you know, we're developing a sake tasting program where guests can come in and experience sake, not just through a restaurant or bar setting, but really through a conversation with myself and with some of our servers and our sake team here at the restaurant. And so, you know, my dream is for everybody to fall in love with sake and to be able to throw a big sake festival here and invite brewers to see how much people are really engaging with sake here in New York City and in Brooklyn. That would be a dream for me to show them how much we appreciate all the hard work that they do.
Right. I'm sure that new shop is going to shorten the distance between sake and general customers, especially you explaining all those things with your sparkling eyes. So yeah, that'll be really amazing. Okay, so where can we find you online and on social media?
The Rule of Thirds Restaurant Instagram account is ThirdsBK. That's ThirdS, and then B as in Brooklyn, K as in Kings. And Bin Bin Sake also has an Instagram. It's just Bin Bin, B-I-N-B-I-N Sake. But personally, if you'd like to find me online, although I am not active on Instagram, there is an account there under Geopad, G-E-O-P-A-D.
Okay. And JT, do you have any personal account?
It's the number 2 LE_JT on Instagram, but I would like to redirect all my my PR stuff to George because he speaks way more eloquently than I can. And yeah.
Okay.
You should follow JT's stories though. JT does post really, really, really great snippets throughout the day, throughout the weeks of behind the scenes at the restaurant.
Oh, that sounds fun. Okay. All right. So thank you so much for joining us today, JT George. So keep us posted and hopefully you can have you back on the show sometime in the near future.
Thank you so much, Akiko-san.
All right, listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. Japanese is a weekly program and always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Aman Wang, and actually today is Amanda's last episode with Japan Eats. So thank you so much for your hard work and good luck. And so also, we'll take a summer break for the rest of the August. So we look forward to seeing you in September. And thank you for listening. Japan Eats is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. and we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.
Listening.